State of Nevada, case number 52521. And I'm going to ask Ms. Nikos first for the state to give an overview of the facts of the case, not too lengthy, and then Mr. Coffey can talk about the defense side of the case and the issues that he's raising as his client was convicted in the trial below, and then we'll proceed with argument. Ms. Nikos, why don't you, when you begin, introduce yourself to the students and tell them where you went to school and your a little bit about your practice before you start. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Coffey, would you please proceed with your argument on behalf of Mr. Gammon?
Thank you, Justice. Justice, good morning. Scott Coffey of the Clark County Public Defender's Office on behalf of Mr. Gamble. I would ask to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal if I might.
Okay.
This case is really simple in a lot of ways, I think. And it comes down to this. It's fundamentally unfair to put somebody on trial for charges that you can't prove. And that's what the state did here with Estrada. Before the trial began, we brought the issue of how the stalking was pled to the district court's attention. There were problems with the way that the stalking was pled. It pled three alternative theories for the state. And they were pled in the disjunctive. Two of those theories contained nothing illegal whatsoever. One was trying to find Deborah Redmond. It's a woman he had been with, had a romantic relationship with for 20 years. That's not illegal. It's not surprising. In fact, if she had disappeared and he hadn't tried to find her, we might be looking at a Scott Peterson-type prosecution. Very simply, what he did made sense. He went to her work. He made phone calls because she stepped off the edge of the earth, and he didn't know where she went. There was no indication at trial ever, or in the pleading documents, and we'll get back to the pleading documents because that's really the crux of things, that she had told him she was going to leave, told him why she was going to leave, told him that there might be another relationship. No indication of any of that. No indication that she even told him that she was done with the relationship. But the state charges stalking. Interestingly, they charge the stalking, not the initial criminal complaint that's filed. They add the stalking when they go to the grand jury. Now, they have the right to add charges when they go to the grand jury, but that always raises a specter in a defense attorney's mind. Why not charge that initially? Well, I think there's a good reason here. You couldn't have this case in front of JP realistically on the stalking charge. I don't think there was probable cause for stalking. Let's take a look at how it was charged specifically, because I think that really would be enlightening. They're charging with stalking. They have the normal boilerplate language. And they say, to wit, threatening Deborah Redmond. Now, we complain there's absolutely no indication of how the threats were made. Was he threatening to steal her mail? Was he threatening to take money from her? What sort of threat? There's no indication of what the threat might be, no indication of a physical threat, which is required for aggravated stalking, by the way. Pretty clearly under a whole line of cases, Rosanna in particular. But there's no indication of what the threat might be. Second prong, second alternative theory. And these are disjunctive. If they prove any one, the jury was entitled to commit, to convict based on this indictment. Telling Deborah Redmond's family or friends that he would kill said Deborah Redmond. At trial of the testimony, and we're skipping ahead, I know we're going backwards and forwards, but we have to some extent. At trial there was testimony from one witness that said, it was Miss Sanders. Clarence came to try to find Redmond. I didn't know where she was at. He asked me to make some phone calls for him. He seemed upset. He complained about money. He had put $500 a month for years into a condo that she had rented. And he said, I want my money. You know, I'm going to kill her. And he may have said that out of frustration. There wasn't anything to rebut the fact that he said that. But that's not stalking, particularly when it's not communicated to the person that he's speaking about. And we asked Ms. Sanders that specifically. Did you ever tell Ms. Redmond about the comment? No. Remember, stalking requires an intent to put the person stalked in immediate fear of bodily harm, of substantial bodily harm for aggravated stalking. This is an offhand comment to a third party that's never communicated to the victim, that the defendant never thinks is going to be communicated to the victim.
How do you know he thinks it? This is a friend of hers, Sanders. It seems to me like he could expect that's going to be communicated to the victim, and I think the statement was, I'm going to kill her when I find her because she owed me for that high house.
I don't believe so, and here's why. Sanders says, I don't know where she's at. I don't have any contact with her. If I'm trying to get a message to her, I'm not sure I go through somebody who says, I don't know where she's at, I don't have any contact with her, she's not in town. And, by the way, stalking requires a course of conduct. Even if there was an isolated threat, one threat is not a course of conduct. It simply isn't. It's not what is required for a stalking charge, particularly an aggravated stalking charge. But I don't think there's any indication that he knew that threat was going to get back to Deborah Redmond. It just doesn't appear that way. It appears to be an offhanded comment at the end of a conversation with Ms. Sanders. The last thing that they charge is by trying to locate her. That's not illegal, as far as I know. There's no indication that she didn't want to be located other than she's gone and nobody's seen her. He goes to her work. He calls friends. He calls family. If my wife disappeared, I'd do the same thing. It's not illegal conduct. And there's no way that the statute is written broadly enough to cover that sort of thing.
Now, but what wasn't it communicated to him that I think it was through Thomas that she was trying to break up with him?
Her brother Thomas said...
He tried to explain in a nice way that she wanted to end the relationship.
Thomas is very interesting, and it's very interesting how it fits in with the rest of the case. Because Thomas says, you know, you're an old man, let it go. He gives a sense, I'm going to paraphrase, but that's essentially Thomas's words. If she doesn't want you, she doesn't want you. Let it go. Thomas testifies that she never communicated that the relationship was done necessarily. She fled to Texas. She takes up with a new man in Texas who just got out of prison, Sammy Shaw. Shaw, after taking up with him, she files for a temporary protective order. But she never follows through on the protective order. She files and then never shows up for any of the hearings. She never discloses Shaw's presence to her own brother, Thomas, which makes you wonder exactly what is going on in Mr. Gamble's mind. What does he have at that point? He knows that she's left, and he doesn't know why. Nobody serves him. He's never served, by the way, with a temporary protective order. And a permanent protective order just never put in place. At the end of the day, it doesn't seem to be stalking. Before trial, we raised this because it's like going into a boxing ring blindfolded with an arm tied behind your back. From this pleading, I can't tell what they're talking about. I just can't tell what they're saying is stalking. What specific act is he doing? Is it going to the hospital and trying to find her? That's not illegal. Is it talking to her friends? That's not illegal. Is it that single threat? That's not enough for stalking. The pleading is defective. It didn't give us notice. And even if it did give us notice, it didn't give a complete charge of stalking. It doesn't, for example, say that this, what the threat to Deborah might have been. It doesn't give the specifics that are necessary to defend a charge. I look at cases like Rosanna where the court talks about what is required for stalking, that there has to be an intent to cause the person to be in fear of bodily harm. It doesn't seem to be this case. It seems the state's argument, for lack of a better characterization...
Well, what do you do with the TPO? She applied for a temporary protective order, and that indicates her fear of this man.
But it doesn't indicate that he knew anything about it. It doesn't indicate that he was never served. He was never told that she had applied for it. She did it in secret, as best I can tell, for lack of a better description, particularly from Clarence's perspective. She files an application and she doesn't show up. She never comes to the court hearing, never makes sworn statements. There's nothing about that that proves stalking one way or the other. We don't know, for example, that other people didn't put her up to it. She'd taken up with a new man in Texas. We don't know the full background of that. We obviously couldn't cross-examine her because she was no longer here. That's part of the problem. We start talking about TPOs that aren't unfollowed, that aren't followed through. I mean, it's very simple
but
to apply.
But we're looking at sufficiency, whether this, any of these errors were harmful, and you're asking us to say this evidence was not sufficient as a matter of law to prove aggravated stalking. And you have the call to, you have the conversation with her friend.
Right.
And you have the application for TPO. Why isn't that sufficient evidence from which any rational juror could find aggravated stalking?
Simply because somebody applied for a TPO. People apply for TPOs all the time. I know district court judges who have ex-spouses who have applied for TPOs.
But in combination with the conversation he had with her friend about wanting to kill her.
Which was never communicated to her. If we are prosecuted for every offhand comment that we make, I could kill that person. Jackie Gleason would have been in jail in 1950. To the moon, Alice. That's not the point. It's an isolated comment, and there's no indication that he took any action on any of those
things.
So your
argument, Mr. Coffey, is that there's a disconnect between the witness's statement about being told this and the TPO. They're unrelated. And so the use of those, particularly in the context of whether the TPO was properly admitted, creates some question about the satisfaction of the elements of aggravated stalking.
Absolutely, and it goes back to the charging document again.
Why don't you talk about the TPO and its admission and the argument that there may be a variance?
Well, that's why the whole thing matters, because we've got a 65-year-old man who is in poor health, and at the end of the day, it would be easy to say the stalking doesn't make much difference. Even if we dismiss it, he's still in prison the rest of his life. The problem is, this is no different than a prior bad act. When the state comes in and pleads a stalking that they can't prove, when they give vague charges and then throw everything they can against the wall and force us to try to defend that, it's no different than a prior bad act. Except in a situation with a prior bad act, we have a little due process. We can demand a hearing. We can ask for clear and convincing evidence of the prior bad act. We can have a relevance versus probative value weighing done by the court pretrial. Those are all required by Tavares. When you charge something that you can't prove, none of that happens, and it infects everything. Think about it this way. Suppose the state had not called him a stalker, had not put the allegation of stalker on paper. Does the trial turn out differently? It very may well have. The label, how we paint people in a courtroom, makes a difference in decisions that juries make. That's why we don't allow in prior bad acts. They can taint the jury pool. A stalking that you can't prove does exactly the same thing. It allows the state to get up and point their finger and say, that's a stalker. It's a stalker, and if it's a stalker and there's a killing, it must be first-degree murder. The argument, I believe, is circular, and I think it starts at the very beginning. She's killed, so it must be stalking. He tried to find it. That must be stalking because she's killed. Well, the killing must be first-degree murder because he was a stalker. There's no way to defend against that, particularly when you don't lay out your theory in the pleading document. It becomes impossible to defend against. You convict him for being a bad person rather than what he might have done. And we pled self-defense. That was our theory at trial. I'm just going to finish my point. But that was our theory at trial, but there was an argument beforehand. They were in the house 30 minutes before the shooting takes place. There were all sorts of arguments for second-degree murder, or perhaps manslaughter based on the argument that took place when they finally confronted each other, because it doesn't look like he went there to kill her. There's this 30-minute exchange. You don't know what this mischarging does to infect the jury's verdict with respect to the murder case. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Coffey. Ms. Nichols.
May it please the Court, Marie Nichols for the State of Nevada. I guess I'll start where we left off with the aggravating stalking. Mr. Coffey continually used the phrase theories of liability when talking about the charging. That is not what that pleading contained. Those were not theories of liability, and we briefed it that way. Remember, 200.575, which is the aggravated stalking statute, states that we have to prove a course of conduct. Those were the items that made up the course of conduct. Those are the actions that he did that made up the course of conduct. Those weren't theories of liability where it's you can take one and not the other. So we were alleging that he threatened her, and or he threatened family or friends, and or he went to try to locate her, and or. Now, the and slash or, it's an artful term that the DA's office tends to use when we have to allege a number of certain things. Because if we do and, then we are locked into every single last one of those. The or is just a protection. If the jury finds that he threatened her family and attempted to locate her, and those two made up the course of conduct, but they don't find the others, they can still find him guilty of aggravated stalking. That was the difference between the and/or and just alleging an and, which I think was Mr. Coffey's complaint, was the ors in there. But we had to prove a course of conduct, not just one item, because what is stalking? Stalking is a pattern of perfectly legal on its own conduct, with the exception of a threat, that when taken together as a whole causes a person to feel terrorized, threatened, harassed, and that in fact is what had happened. Mr. Coffey had indicated there was no indication that there was a breakup to the defendant. That's not true. As you pointed out, it was Thomas's testimony that when he spoke to the defendant, he said, "Man, didn't she tell you she was done with you? Let it go." That he conveyed a threat to Louise Sanders after giving her a list of phone numbers that he couldn't get through. "Hey, you try these for me." He conveyed a threat to her. Then Deborah Redmond comes back, fills out a TPO. And when she comes back, remember, it's not just the TPO. She didn't stay at her own house. She stayed at the Sahara. And also, while she's gone, It was Thomas's testimony. He changed the locks on the house because Clarence Gamble had a key. There were cameras installed. The neighbors testified that no one else in the neighborhood had cameras on their house. They even went so far as to put a padlock on the garage door that you had to open with a key so that the garage door couldn't be opened by Clarence Gamble using his clicker. She knew about these threats. She was terrorized and frightened of him, and we proved the aggravated stalking. Now, the TPO, that was paramount, not only the aggravated stalking, but to go to Clarence Gamble's state of mind and to rebut this self-defense claim that was coming and that did come in at trial. He's the primary aggressor. He's the one that shows up, parks miles away. I'll use miles delicately, but far, far, far away from where her apartment is. Walks up that little greenbelt area. He's seen by the neighbors making that lengthy walk. It's his testimony that he just went there to get his stuff. He didn't want to confront her. He just, well, actually on cross-examination, he did finally admit he wanted to confront her. He was angry and he wanted answers. But this sickly Clarence Thomas parks all the way down there just to get his stuff. And then there's the confrontation in the garage. The confrontation in the garage is because Deborah Redmond had forgotten to put that padlock on the garage. She's on the phone with Mr. Shaw and says, I forgot to put the padlock on. Goes down to the garage. Clarence Gamble's down there. And that phone conversation was available for that jurors to hear because it somehow wound up on Thomas's voicemail. And the confrontation was there. And it was very clear to some of the jurors, this ain't no game, woman. And he chases her down. And the testimony was that there was a blood trail from the garage coming out in the opposite direction of Mr. Gamble's car, mind you, down the little stairwell into where that greenbelt area is, to where she's finally lying. Now,
should we be concerned that there wasn't a per se Petruccelli airing talking about the testimony about the TPO, that there wasn't a per se Petruccelli airing or findings under Tinch?
The problem was that was not ever alleged as an other bad act. It was alleged as part and parcel to, it was a, basically, the totality of the case, the totality of the circumstances of the case. This was not...
This raises a very interesting legal question. I can understand your offering the testimony in support of the contention that there's a course of conduct, but as part of the evidence that's introduced in these kinds of cases to support course of conduct, it may necessarily involve bad act evidence, which this court has said repeatedly requires limiting instructions, and there was none in this case.
There was none requested by the defense either.
Well, but as you know, this court has said that the prosecution and the court have an independent responsibility to assure that limiting instructions are given when bad act evidence is admitted. That didn't happen here.
The difference is there is not an error because the TPO in and of itself is not a bad act evidence. Remember, the only evidence that came in was that she sought a temporary protective order. The actual physical application itself was out because it contained bad act evidence and it contained hearsay that was under no exception. And we left that out intentionally because the second half of, you know, the second page of the TPO is basically her application where she talks about him threatening her and putting, you know, and assaulting her and the events that led up to the crying conversation with Thomas and Cassandra where they put her on the plane.
Doesn't that create a risk when the jury only hears that there's been a TPO application? Doesn't that create a risk of speculation on the part of the jury as to what was the basis for the TPO? Was it connected to the statement made to the witness? Is it connected to something else? Without the limited instruction, seems to present a problem. I wonder if you could address that.
There are a variety of things that can create a risk of speculation on behalf of the jury. The mere fact that we had aggravated stalking alleged created some speculation on behalf of the jury. The witnesses stating that they knew Deborah was afraid created speculation. you can't put on a criminal case without the jurors reaching some type of speculation. But the mere action of a victim seeking a temporary protective order is not in and of itself a bad act. We were not alleging a bad act on behalf of Mr. Thomas. And there is no error here. I can see where the court may want to give a caution to courts in the future.
You are alleging that the TPO constitutes evidence to support your contention. This is a course of conduct, one of the elements necessary to aggravated stalking. I presume you argued it that way.
Actually, no. We argued the TPO not as part of the course of conduct, but we also had to prove that Deborah, in fact, felt terrorized, threatened. That's what we needed to prove. We never argued that the TPO itself lended credence to the course of conduct. The course of conduct was one thing. Step two of what we have to prove is that Deborah herself felt terrorized, threatened, or harassed by this. So absolutely not. It was never argued that way.
The TPO wasn't helpful to support a course of conduct argument. Then why was it admissible at all?
Because it was helpful to not to support this course of conduct, but to support the fact that she felt this way. And also, as part two, when we get down to deciding whether this is first-degree murder or a self-defense issue, that's where it comes into play as well, is that Mr. Gamble is the primary aggressor.
Assuming that the panel had some reservations about the admissibility of the TPO or that there was a Tavares or Tinch error, could you address whether it's harmless or not?
I believe it's absolutely harmless in this case. The evidence was overwhelming in this case as to first-degree murder against Mr. Gamble. The only person who, and this will go into the prosecutorial misconduct, the only person that ever puts a gun in Deborah Redmond's hand is Clarence Gamble. And the fact that she purchased a gun was also evidence that she felt terrorized and threatened by him. But as Jesse Luvanos passes that garage, he waves to her. She doesn't wave back like she normally does. Then she begins to run out of the garage, say, he's got a gun, call the police. Clarence isn't the one saying, she has a gun, call the police. Clarence is chasing after her. She is shot through her left hand, going through her chest in an upward direction, which the medical examiner had testified that is an upward direction. He can't say where the position was, but if the jurors are to use their common sense, it lends credence to someone standing over her and shooting her while she's down to get that angle. She was shot through her right hand, completely through, which Dr. Telgenhoff testified was probably the most unique wound he's ever seen in his entire life. That while defensive wounds don't really exist in gunshot cases, if they did, this would be it. This was a contact wound through her right hand. So she's shot through both of her hands. And Jesse Luvanos sees Mr. Gamble kneeling down next to her, attempting to place a gun in her hand after she's already down, but the gun won't stay because she's convulsing. The evidence was absolutely overwhelming. This was first-degree murder. He then drops the gun down and calmly walks away. Calmly walks away. He doesn't have a mark on him, with the exception of Deborah Redmond's blood at the bottom of his pant legs. Not a single mark. And that blood trail starts at that garage, goes down that stairwell in the complete opposite direction of his car, even though his claim is that she was attacking him and he was just trying to get away from her. It was overwhelming in this case. That would be absolutely harmless error. It is harmless error if there's any error at all. The state's certainly not stating that there's any error. if I could briefly just address the prosecutorial misconduct, because that was briefed. the premeditation instructions. Obviously, I made a misstep when I stated is instantaneous as a successive thoughts of the mind. Mr. Coffey corrected me. I corrected myself in front of a juror. That, again, is harmless error. and the comments about referring to the defendant's story. That is not the same thing as calling it a red herring or a hustle, which is what the case law that they cited is. It's not the same thing. It was his story. There was Jesse Luvanos' story. His story didn't make sense. It didn't, and this jury certainly saw that. And now to the instructions. The defense proposed an instruction, if the evidence is susceptible of two constructions or interpretations, each of which appears to you to be reasonable, and one of which points to the guilt of the defendant and the other to his innocence, it is your duty under the law to adopt the interpretation which will admit the defendant's innocence and reject that which points to their guilt. It's my understanding and my recollection, when I spoke to Mr. Coffey this morning, the instructions were pretty much settled without any objections, with the exception of this one that Mr. Coffey had had proposed. And when he proposed it, he included the case law on this, which was Bales v. State, that states, we have heretofore considered such an instruction in cases involving both direct and circumstantial evidence and have ruled that it is not error to refuse to give the instruction if the jury is properly instructed regarding reasonable doubt. And they were properly instructed on the standard of reasonable doubt. This was a cumulative instruction, and it was certainly not error in this case not to give it. There was eyewitness testimony. The cases where this instruction has been given were cases of circumstantial evidence. This one, we had absolute eyewitness testimony from Jesse Luvanos. There was no error at all to not include this instruction. There were some arguments made about the voluntary manslaughter instructions, that they didn't include language that the injury could be emotional. Again, even though we didn't include any language that it could just be an emotional injury, not a physical injury, when Ms. Benedict was giving her closing argument explaining the instructions, the example she gave was an emotional injury. Mr. Coffey argued an emotional injury. That was certainly no error in that, and no instruction was sought, so I don't think this court should even consider that. Also, with regard to the self-defense instructions, something brought up in the appeal about the self-defense instruction regarding it must appear that the danger is so substantial that you must take the life of another. That is exact wording out of NRS 200.200. That is the proper instruction, and there was no objection there. Thank you. My time is up.
Thank you, Ms. DeCosta. Are there any questions, counsel, by the panel? Okay, thank you. Mr. Coffey?
Simple question. 65-year-old man, poor health. You know the stalking is going to be a problem. You know you're going to be in front of this court at some point on the stalking charge because the defense took it up pre-trial. Why push that issue? It's for one reason. It's because it allows you the wholesale admission of bad acts evidence. You get around the bad acts hearings. You get around the bad acts instructions. There's no other reason to push that issue from the state side other than to circumvent the other proof problems that they would have putting these things on as a bad act. The state says the TPO proves Clarence's state of mind. He doesn't know about the TPO. How on earth does that prove his state of mind? It couldn't have been admitted for that purpose. A minute later, they say we didn't use it for that. We used it to prove her state of mind. Well, which is it? That's the problem with the vague pleading, the problem that we brought to the district court's attention before the trial began. When you have vague pleadings, there was a threat. And I am a prosecutor. It allows me to walk into a courtroom and say anything I want under the auspices of proving a threat. I asked the state for a clear pleading. What threat was it? The district court said, no, you're not entitled to that. It makes a case impossible to defend. It allows for the wholesale admission of any and everything in a person's past without having to disclose your hand to the defense. It is a due process violation. That is the reason that we had problems with this from the beginning. The alternative theories also or an issue here. They use and/or and they say it's just a sleight of hand, but when you put or in there, a jury could simply have convicted him for trying to find his lover of 22 years. It says or, any one of the three will suffice. That's the way the English language works. It's inappropriate to charge it that way, particularly when one of the points is a theory that cannot sustain a criminal conviction. It's a Yates violation. U.S. Supreme Court, it's a Yates violation. You simply can't do that. It's interesting also the spin that you get to put on things. Nobody said where he parked was inappropriate. Nobody said he hadn't parked there in the past. Nobody said that isn't where he shouldn't have parked. But now the state says, well, parked too far away, that must mean he had something evil in mind. See how this whole painting works. See how the brushstrokes work.
I have one final question, Mr. Coffey, which I'd like you to address. Assuming for the moment that the panel had some reservation about the admissibility of the TPO, why isn't that harmless error? There does seem to be considerable evidence to still support the first-degree murder conviction. Aggravated stalking may be some question, but the altercation in the garage and the subsequent events, the gunshot injuries, all seem to support the first-degree murder conviction. Can you persuade us otherwise?
They might. They might also support a second-degree murder conviction. They might also support a verdict of voluntary manslaughter. It's a relationship for 22 years. He's been trying to find answers for why she's left him. That doesn't happen. He goes into her house. There's no altercation initially in the house. One of the witnesses, Jesse Lovanos, who the state relies on so heavily, but the jury doesn't because they hang on the assault charge against Mr. Lovanos, sees them standing in the garage having a normal conversation. Mr. Gamble waves as they pass by. It appears that this happened as a result of an argument. The context of the argument, well, it's the context of the argument would normally be in a dispute between lovers, I would submit. It is over money, it is over love, it is over rejection, it is all those things that emotionally cripple us, and it is those sorts of things that could put it into a situation which would amount to voluntary manslaughter, heat of passion. I know he chases her, but that's a jury decision as to how long that heat of passion remains, how that heat of passion dissipates. Similar thing, it's hard to believe that a man of 65 years with no criminal record thought his way through this and weighed the consequences for and against him. That's a requirement for first-degree murder. This wasn't a felony murder case. He had to weigh the consequences for and against, and there's no indication in the record that he did that other than to say he's a stalker. He must have thought his way through it. It's not harmless error.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Coffey. Any questions by my colleagues? All right, then the case will stand submitted for a decision by the panel.